This is The Allusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, make the leftovers of language into a big sandwich. Today's episode is the end of 2016 bonus edition of The Allusionist, wherein we hear some bits and pieces from this year's guests that didn't fit into the episodes but I thought were interesting. Also, I've pulled out a few of your etymological requests from the coffers. Thanks very much for sending those in throughout the year, and apologies if I have not replied or etymologised yet. The Allusionist is mostly a one-horse operation, and the horse can open neither emails nor the dictionary. Don't know why I keep it on payroll, really. If this is your first Allusionist, welcome. Go and listen to a few more typical episodes. This year there have been shows about how if you spend too much time in Antarctica, your ability to use words freezes, how to rewrite your online dating profile to find the person of your dreams, how language is being preserved in the event of apocalypse, how Brits and Americans use the word please in different ways. That episode got the most strong and varied responses of any episode so far. I have learnt a lot this year. And thanks very much for allowing me into your ears during that process. On with the show. Here's an etymological request from Drew. Drew says, sanguine. I would love to know why this word means what it does instead of, say, covered in blood. Well, sanguine can mean bloody and blood-coloured, from its origin in the Latin for blood, sanguis. But I'm assuming that Drew wants to know why sanguine is a personality trait, a cheerful, upbeat one. This is related to the four humours theory of medicine, popularised nearly 2,500 years ago by Hippocrates, the Greek father of Western medicine. For some 2,000 years after him, the four humours remained scientifically significant. The theory was any malady could be ascribed to an imbalance of the four humours, or bodily fluids, blood, yellow bile, black bile, and phlegm. So if you had a problem attributed to having too much blood, that could be fixed with bloodletting. Or if you were prone to having too much yellow bile, you'd eat cooling foods like cucumbers to counteract yellow bile's fieriness, because each humour also corresponded with an element, earth, air, fire, and water, and a season, a colour, a time of day, sign of zodiac, and emotions. In fact, you can relate the word temperament to this as well. It's from the Latin temperare, to mix, referring to how a person's character was influenced by their combination of humours. Bit like a Myers-Briggs personality test, but composed of bodily fluids. Here's where sanguine comes in. Blood was considered the most positive of the humours, associated with joy and optimism. If your personal balance of humours favoured blood, you had a sanguine personality. Phlegmatic people were not only phlegmy, they were calm, perhaps to the point of apathy. A temperament dominated by yellow bile was known as choleric, meaning irascible. Bile words are frequently synonyms for anger, but the col part of the bile-related word choleric you also hear in melancholy, the low spirits that resulted from an excess of the black bile humour. The four humours gave us several familiar words. On the subject of medicine, here's Dr. Isaac Siemens, who appeared in the Name That Disease episode talking about medical eponyms. I had to ask him about some other important medical terminology.
How often do you say things like stat and just talk in numbers and letters?
So I'm interested in palliative care, which is a lot of communication with patients and families that are going through like death or very emotionally charged situations. And so communication is super important. And in palliative care, we spend a lot of time trying to really reflect on the language we're using, because you get so used to jargon and you overhear yourself doing it and colleagues doing it all the time, where you realize that you're using words that are basically like cat or apple to us that mean absolutely nothing to patients. And so I catch myself doing it all the time. But, you know, saying stat always sounds cool. And I only recently learned what stat actually means, or it's short for statum, which just means like right away, I guess, in Latin.
And you didn't guess that from watching ER?
Well, I figured it meant like I need something now, but I never really understood what exactly you were saying. But my like pet peeve is that for some reason, instead of saying by mouth in medicine, we say PO, which stands for per os. You'll hear it if you go to the emergency department or you're in the hospital. You'll hear people telling patients all the time, like, oh, you'll just take that medication, PO. People just nod. And then once the doctor leaves, they just look at each other and say, like, what was he just talking about? We have no idea. So
where in my body is that medicine going?
Yeah, exactly. It sounds, it's like, could be per anything. I don't know. Per rectum? We don't know.
It must be hard, though, when you're in work mode to flip between.
Mm-hmm. It is. And it's an efficiency thing, right? Like, the language is really specific and quick, like saying stat. Everyone involved, like all the healthcare professionals, will know what you're talking about. So it's effective and quick, and that's why it's so easy to use. But then, yeah, having to switch back and forth with patients, you have to be really, really conscious of what you're doing. And sometimes it's good to be able to say things in front of people without them knowing what you're saying. So I think that's another useful part of jargonism.
What are some of the other doctor slang terms that we should know about? Or we shouldn't know about.
I'm worried that I might get kicked out of Dr. Land for explaining them. But one common one is supratentorial. The tentorium is this anatomical area that sort of separates the brain from the rest of the body. And when you describe a condition as supratentorial, what you mean is like it's all in their head, rather than like you would say like, oh, this patient has some condition, but we highly suspect it's supratentorial and that they're just like anxious or making it up. And so that would be a typical thing that you might say in a crowded room, just so that people know what you're talking about, but nobody else does. So that would be I think it's mean to do, but people do it. Yeah, just disclaimer.
The following etymological request is not a dig at Dr. Isaac Siemens, but Harriet wrote, I work in a hospital, and the other day I spoke with colleagues about the term quack, an unscrupulous bogus doctor. I was wondering if you knew why quack has this meaning, aside from the adorable sound a duck makes. It's nothing to do with ducks, but a shortening of a word which English poached from Dutch around 1570, quacksalver. In Dutch, the quack was from the verb quacken, to brag, and the salver, as in salves, ointments. The quacksalvers sold salves, the implication being that the salves they were flogging were no more medically effective than anointing yourself with absolute nonsense. Eric says, I was wondering how the word cataract came to mean both a waterfall and an eye condition of blurred vision. I'm not seeing the connection between the two. Some try to explain it as water churned up by a waterfall looks white, and so does an eye with a cataract, but I don't think that's really the linguistic connection. Come with me, Eric, back to ancient Greek, in which the word cataractes meant something swooping or rushing down. That's classic waterfall behaviour, but when cataract was co-opted into Latin, it meant other down-rushing things, like floodgates and portcullises. And it's more likely that those were the analogies for the ocular opacity sense of cataract, being a barrier to clear vision. Name developer Nancy Friedman appeared in the Brandit episode, talking about the process of coming up with names and taglines for brands and trends therein. Recently, she's been keeping an eye on name trends in the legal marijuana business.
We're just seeing the start of it, and there tends to be a lot of copycatting. Colorado is the best case. Right now, they've had legal marijuana for the longest time, and Washington is starting. So we're seeing a lot of very small businesses that use leaf and green and herb, and they use the same logo. There are also starting to be branding agencies that specialize in legal marijuana. And in Colorado, there's one, and it's run by women, and women are really getting into this in a big way. It's interesting to see. And they're trying to move away from the cliches and the hippie, you know, associations, and going for a more elegant, soothing, spa-like effect with names that reflect that. And right around here,
Nancy and I met up in Oakland, California.
As I walked here today, I passed a big bus shelter ad for first of all, they're saying cannabis and not marijuana, and it's Kana, K-A-N-A, is a whole line of products that are California grown in the sunshine and aren't hydroponic. And so there's this sort of elegant, elusive kind of name. But we're still going to see a lot of, you know, really kind of hokey, groany, punny names. A lot of Mary Jane still, and a lot of 420, lots and lots and lots of 420 names, which get confused. You know, they will. The object of a name is to make your business distinctive, and if you're the same, using the same three numbers,
Well, they're still a young industry. They haven't learned yet.
Yes.
Is it the case that if you choose one of those quite classy, spa-like names, you can charge more for the product?
Well, I'm sure that's what they're thinking. You know, they're trying to make it just seem more upscale, more premium.
Not so medicalized either.
True. So, yeah, it's quite an interesting time.
So in 5 years' time, things could have come quite a long way.
Well, what they're saying is that the big alcohol and tobacco brands are going to move in and kind of gather a lot of these small brands under their wing and rebrand everything.
So you get Marlboro cannabis.
Yeah, well, we're already, let's see, there's already Marley, named after Bob Marley, and Willie Nelson has his own brand of cannabis munchies, I think.
Very yeah. prudent business.
Yeah. So that's called borrowed interest, borrowed equity, when you take a celebrity name.
When I was, I don't know, 9 years old, my friends and I used to hide in the bathroom and sneak a look at rude words in the dictionary. It was a pre-internet time, but now the dictionary is online. Even though people could get much more substantial kicks with just a click, habits haven't changed all that much. Jane Solomon from dictionary.com came on the Word of the Day episode, and while examining data of people's dictionary.com search habits, one thing she noticed
is this very strange pattern where people would look up a bunch of words, and then when they were done with their search, they would choose a sort of vulgar default word to end their search, and then they would bounce from the site. So here's an example of one of these searches that we came across in our data just by looking at a bunch of searches and wondering what it meant. November, octopus, octopus. Then there are three misspellings of Pisces, I think. Octopus, genus, octopus, astatine, remora, and fart. So in terms of what is this person doing? I mean, clearly fart is the default word that they've just decided to type when they don't know what to type. Some insight on the order of it. I know that I looked at the definition for octopus and it has genus in it. So the octopus genus octopus pattern might be them clicking on the word genus in the definition, which is a link, and then maybe pressing the back button. So we can guess what this is about, but we don't know for sure. But maybe the person who made this search
wanted to know if octopuses fart?
That's a very real question.
I googled, do octopuses fart? And the answers were not conclusive. Some say that octopuses do fart, they fart ink. I tried to find out if there's a more technical term for octopuses shooting ink, and inking seems to be it. But along the way, I found out that squid can shoot ink in specific shapes, for instance smaller prey, to divert their predators. Well played, squid. Roderick says, gaslighting. I heard it recently. Is it a real compound word in the dictionary? Yes, light filled by gas. Or slang for something. Yes, slang for psychologically manipulating someone until they no longer trust their own sanity. Spoiler alert for Gaslight, a 1944 film remake of Gaslight, a 1940 film adapted from Gaslight, a 1938 play. The details vary a little in these different versions of Gaslight, but the upshot is, domineering husband and vulnerable younger wife move into a new home. When the wife's possessions disappear or her husband is absent without explanation, he convinces her she's imagining it all, including her notion that the gas lamps in their home are intermittently dimming. But she's not going insane. The lights are in fact dimming because the supply of gas to her lamps is reduced when the lamps elsewhere in the building are switched on, such as when the husband is in the flat upstairs searching for jewels he failed to find previously when he burgled the place and murdered the woman who lived there. So although gaslighting is a term from popular culture that has entered the common lexicon, actually understanding why it means what it means requires knowledge not only of the films or the play, but also outmoded lighting technology. Gaslighting is a pretty grim way to treat someone, but here's divorce lawyer Nick Allen, who appeared in the post-love episode. Here he's talking about some other causes of a relationship's demise.
A lot of the time you get the feeling that people have stopped putting effort into the relationship, and other times you feel that one party's taken the other for granted, or that they have felt undermined if the couple have gone out socially and, you know, one of them's spent more time talking to friends without seeing how their spouse is. So, you know, these are all examples of unreasonable behaviour, which is the main ground for divorcing or dissolving your civil partnership. But the vast majority of the time, the grounds that I see in a divorce petition that are said to be unreasonable behaviour are no really worse than you get with any couple any day of the week, and drafting the unreasonable behaviour particulars, as they are they're described, are only a means to an end.
Loaded the dishwasher wrongly.
Didn't put the cutlery in the right way up. In, I mean, I've seen people in divorce petitions making reference to throwing the tea bag straight in the bin rather than putting the tea bag in the special tea bag, you know, strainer or whatever you might call it on the side. Now, who knew that was a ground for divorce?
It's the little things that make you want to stab your spouse to death.
Yeah, and the little things that you can put in your divorce petition, say to a judge they are grounds of unreasonable behaviour, and the judge looks at them and says he or she is satisfied that you've proved the unreasonable behaviour and therefore you're entitled to your decree of divorce or your interim order if it's a civil partnership.
But maybe the term unreasonable should be replaced by increasingly aggravating.
Yes.
Profoundly irritating.
Profoundly irritating or annoying for 3 weeks out of four. I don't know.
This episode was produced by me, Helen Zaltzman, with music by Martin Austwick. Thanks also to Chica Ayres and Devon Taylor for their help with The Illusionist during this year. Your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is nuchal, adjective, anatomy, of or relating to the nape of the neck. Try using it in an email today. To find the show online, seek out Illusionist Show on Facebook and Twitter, and visit me at shows forever home, theillusionist.org.